Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. This week with me, Annabelle Quince.
Mexico's deadly swine flu outbreak is now on the brink of sparking a global pandemic.
In Mexico City, mobile health clinics have sprung up to deal with people who feel sick.
There are now more than 200 cases of swine flu in 30 American states, but health officials are hoping the worst is over.
Influenza is a serious virus, but the good news is when we look at this virus right now, we're not seeing some of the things in the virus that have been associated in the past with more severe flu. That's encouraging, but it doesn't mean we're out of the woods yet.
Almost 2 weeks ago, swine flu or influenza A H1N1 was identified in Mexico City and since then has claimed at least 19 lives. The virus has now spread to 18 countries, and last week the World Health Organization, or WHO, raised the influenza pandemic alert level to phase 5, which basically means the WHO considers a pandemic is imminent. This week there are signs that the virus may not be as dangerous as first suspected, but medical authorities are still on high alert for fear that the virus may turn out to be as deadly as the virus that sparked the 1918-1919 pandemic, which killed around 50 million people. Today on Rear Vision, we're going to take a look at the 1918-19 flu pandemic and hear the stories of three Australians who experienced the pandemic firsthand. But before we get to that, what is it that makes the influenza virus so dangerous and unpredictable? Geoffrey Rice is Professor of History at the University of Canterbury and the author of Black November, the 1918 influenza pandemic in New Zealand.
One of the funny things about influenza is its capacity to surprise and puzzle. It is one of the most quickly mutating and changing diseases around. I mean, there are a lot of classic diseases like other bacteria-based diseases, which are very predictable and they follow a normal pattern. But influenza is very odd. In the historical record, it behaves epidemiologically in unexpected and unpredictable ways. I think that's what makes the risk of a worldwide pandemic from this current H1N1 outbreak a little bit scary, because we just don't know what it's going to do next. It's very hard to predict.
According to Niall Johnson, author of Britain and the 1918-19 influenza pandemic, what makes influenza so unpredictable is its ability to change.
It's important to realise that flu changes in two ways. There's what's called an antigenic drift and an antigenic shift. Antigenic drift is how we get a normal changing flus. It's why we have to do a new vaccine each year, because the virus will undergo random changes, very closely related but very slightly different. Now, the other one I mentioned is an antigenic shift, and this is where you get this huge change. It seems in 1918, and it seems perhaps now in the Mexican case, what you had is in a single host, whether it was a human, a bird, a pig, you've had two or more strains of flu infecting the same host at the same time. And they have then recombined, reassorted, to give you a completely new virus. And this is a virus which no one has any immunity to. But can it get into humans? Can it go then from human to human? Now, with the bird flus, we've been around for the last 10, 15 years. While there have been over 120 deaths, there's very few, if any, which have been caused from human-to-human transmission. Nearly all those people who've died had direct or close contact with birds. Now, what seems to be happening in Mexico is you're getting human-to-human transmission, person-to-person, and that's a key enabler. Now, the next couple of things are, how effective is that transmissibility? How efficient is that virus? Because normal flu is very, very efficient. It moves through us very, very quickly. And if it has this ability to spread very quickly, you can get very high proportions of a population infected. And again, even if a case fatality rate isn't very high, if you've got 100 million people infected in 3 weeks, even if 1% of that dies, it's still an awful lot of people. And that's what happened in 1918. We think perhaps as much as half a world population, a billion people out of the 2 billion estimated, were infected.
While the historical records suggest that influenza has been around for millennium, We know for certain that has been with us for at least 300 years. John Barry is a historian and the author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history.
In the last 300 years or so, when people started taking more careful note of symptoms, and then we're pretty sure there have been at least 10 pandemics in the last 300 years, there are four pandemics that are relatively recent and we know about in some detail, and that would be 1889, 1918, of course, which gets all the attention because it was so deadly, 1957 and 1968.
The influenza virus that caused the 1918 pandemic started to spread at the beginning of 1918, but didn't reach Australia until 1919.
And that year started with the outbreak of the flu epidemic, and the university closed for several weeks. Everybody in the community wore masks, and the death rate was very high. You'd be talking to somebody today, and in a couple of days, they'd be dead.
Well, you know, a lot of people had thought it had started in March in military camp in Kansas, but I actually traced it back to rural Kansas in January 1918, and I think the best evidence suggests that it started there. There's actually a major, you know, the biggest bird flyway in North America goes right through there. There are other hypotheses, including one that it started in France 2 years earlier and then went completely underground. There are other people who think that it started in Vietnam and China, but I don't think the evidence for those locations is particularly good. I think the two leading hypotheses are the one that I came up with when I was researching my book in Kansas, and obviously I think that's the most likely one, or I wouldn't have published it, but another one with decent evidence is France in 1915 or 16.
There are a range of theories and hypotheses. One which has been held for a long time was it came out of Midwest America, Midwestern pigs, pigs in places like Iowa and Kansas, and certainly some of the early reports of high numbers of people being ill with what seems like flu are in some of the American military encampments throughout the Midwest. And that argument then sees them being linked to outbreaks in Boston, Brest in France, and Sierra Leone. And again, the argument's made that these are all connected by American military movements, troops being moved towards the Western Front. Where the 1918 flu comes from is hard to say. John Oxford in London, I've worked with him on some work which looks at some of the early reports amongst British forces, and we put them quite early on in 1918, even in late 1917, in Western France amongst British troops. But remember, I mean, a British encampment like the, if you like, almost military city of Etarp would have had troops from all over the Commonwealth, all over the Empire rather, including Asian labourers. So it's a contentious story. There are lots of different stories you can find. I don't know if there's any way we're actually ever going to really find where was that single sentinel case. Will we be able to track that down? And then also, what does it really tell you?
So how quickly did that, from when it originated, from wherever it originated, how quickly did the influenza spread in 1918?
Well, there was, if my hypothesis is correct, it went from rural Kansas with draftees to an army base in Kansas where it erupted in early March. And within a couple of weeks, it was in almost every army camp in the United States and went with some American troops to Europe. It also started to spread through the civilian population in both Europe and the United States. And eventually, I think that first wave, which really lasted until late summer, or at least early summer, went pretty much around the world, but it was not thorough. It was sporadic. There were some cities that it completely missed. In fact, the best study of the epidemic, at least in the English language, was written in 1927, and it observed that the spring wave, quote, had a tendency to peter out, unquote. In other words, the virus was really not terrifically efficient at infecting people. And another point to be made about that first wave was that it was very mild. It was actually milder than ordinary influenza. It was so mild that medical journals, were actually printing articles suggesting that although the symptoms seemed a lot like influenza, it was so mild they didn't think it was that disease. They thought it was a different disease. But in late August, actually I guess in early August in Switzerland, all of a sudden it erupted in a violent form to the extent that there is secret intelligence cables from Switzerland sent back to the United States that are now in the U.S. National Archives that said this is supposed to be influenza, but it's really the Black Plague. That's how quickly it changed. It just suddenly clicked into a virulent form, and it erupted pretty violently, very quickly. It moved around the world. Africa, Boston was the first hard-hit city in the United States. It spread within a few weeks.
The second severe wave, it's very clear the origin of that severe wave was the Western Front in northeastern France. The dates, the maps, the patterns of transmission are very, very clear that something happened there. And there's been a lot of debate among medical historians, of course, as to what made the 1918 flu suddenly become so lethal. At a time when we didn't know very much about viruses, people seemed to think that, oh, something had happened, that it had recombined with perhaps a Russian form, had combined with a Chinese form and produced a sort of terrible virulent super flu, but that now seems unlikely. What happened to make the 1918 virus, the mild virus of the early part of the year, so deadly? There are several different theories. One that was actually published in the New Zealand Medical Journal by a British scientist who'd been involved in wartime experiments on mustard gas just put forward the very interesting proposition that the 1918 pandemic occurred in very, very unusual world history circumstances. In other words, it was the First World War, which is, remember, a very unusual war, unprecedented in history because of the technology. It was the first war of mass industrialization. So the technology, submarines, torpedoes, planes, all sorts of things were new, machine guns especially, and chemical warfare. And the Germans were right into chemical warfare. And this scientist pointed out that you have this very unusual set of circumstances combining. You had a mild, ordinary flu, as it seemed, widespread among the troops on both sides of the front line at a time when they were exploding thousands of mustard gas shells. And a lot of mustard gas was mingling with the air and drifting around in very, very low concentrations. Well, the experiments they did in Britain in 1940, because they were terrified the Germans would use mustard gas again in the Second World War, they found very interestingly that under lab conditions, diluted mustard gas has an interesting effect on very simple organisms like molds and bacteria. It speeds up their reproduction rate. And so the scientist said, well, there's really no scientific reason why it shouldn't do that for viruses as well. So perhaps that's what made it a sort of super flu. I'm a little skeptical myself about this one because I'm not a scientist and I can't follow the scientific arguments. But as a historian, looking at the circumstances of the First World War, you had a very specialized population in a relatively confined part of northeastern France, not just thousands, but millions of troops, men in their 20s and 30s, often fit young men, and their immune systems, of course, would be much more active than, say, an elderly population. And here they were dealing with what was originally a mild virus. My guess is that the virus, to survive in a young, fit population, it encountered very active immune systems. And by natural selection, the viruses that spread were the ones that were smartest and bred fastest. And what emerged was a kind of super flu, a flu which was highly infectious, knocked you over quickly, and it spread with remarkable rapidity right around the world.
And then they used to have this big cart going around, and it was a big, long, flat cart with two horses, and if you had dead people in the house, sometimes they had boxes made out of fruit boxes, and other times they wrapped the bodies up in the blankets and just put them all on this cart and took them away. I don't know where they took them to or where they buried them or anything.
The unusual nature of the virus was that it killed people who were normally never die of influenza, healthy young adults. The reason that influenza usually kills the very young and the elderly is because your immune system changes over time. It's weakest when you're an infant, and then it gets stronger, and then it gets weaker again as you get older. So those are normally the people who are killed. But in 1918 was entirely different. 1918, over half the deaths were healthy young adults, when what seems to have been happening was the immune system was actually the one killing the people.
There's a fairly well-developed literature now among the on the medical side and the epidemiologists that it's the obverse of the idea of the selection of a super flu on the Western Front, that it affected people in the prime of life much more because their immune systems were very active and resisted the invasive virus more vigorously. And the idea was that their immune systems simply went into anaphylactic shock and overproduced, trying to smother the invasive virus. And the effect of that, of course, was to produce fluid, and their lungs just sort of filled up with excess fluid, especially when you had inflammation caused by the virus inside the lung lining, where the little blood vessels began to burst and leak into the lung. Because the autopsies on most of these victims of the flu showed the lungs consolidated, almost, you know, full of fluid and mucus and blood. These poor people literally drowned in their own bodily secretions. Their lungs just filled up with their own body fluids. And because of the inability of the lungs to exchange oxygen, their skin lost its normal healthy pink appearance and turned a sort of dusky purple or black. My grandmother always referred to this as the black flu because the bodies turned black. That was one of the horrifying things and why they buried them as quickly as they possibly could, because they then started to decompose rather rapidly and smellily as well.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with me, Annabelle Quince. Today we're taking a look at the 1918-1919 flu pandemic.
We could see the funerals going along the street. I said to the matron, "What can I do?" She said, "You're doing all that we're doing. We don't know what to do. No one knows what to do." She said in the hospital, it was full, and they were brought in one day and they were dead sometimes in a couple of days. It was just shocking.
There were many responses. I have a quote in my book from a Canadian GP who basically says, "We gave up. We didn't know what to do. We just sent people home to bed." If you look in the UK, where they had a nascent national system under the local government board, which predates the Ministry of Health, but the actual activities around health were done at local level through the local medical office of health, and you find there a range of responses. To some, MOHs are effectively denying they had any flu. You can read their reports and they will write, "Flu, we didn't have any." And you turn to the tables at the back of the report and you find most of the deaths in their borough that year were flu-related. Other places you have very strenuous efforts. The Medical Officer of Health in Manchester, James Niven, and John Roberts in Birmingham were both very active. James Niven organised house-to-house surveys and inspections by nurses and members of his public health team. He organised a delivery of coal, milk, Glaxo powdered milk, and whatever treatments they could get. Some of those were just routine cough treatments. And so there was, in some places you do have this outpouring of effort. In one place I've worked in Canada, the local authorities organised volunteer nurses to go around house to house. The manufacturers in that city organised are nursing teams for their workforce. Some of them intentionally shut their businesses and then sent out these volunteer nurses to keep tabs on their employees, seeing how they were doing. Closures and quarantine became very popular. Quarantine at national level was discussed in many countries, rejected in many countries. Australia was one country which did enforce it for a long time. You find certain individual communities trying to quarantine themselves. And in some places you find these quarantines being enforced by riders on shotguns. They make very strenuous efforts to keep people out. There's also in many places arguments about the closure of schools. That happened in Australia, happened in the UK. The wearing of face masks, as we're already seeing in this outbreak, became a very contentious issue. I mean, and some of the images from 1918, I've got an image somewhere of staff of Balmain Post Office sat out on the steps of a post office wearing face masks. And there are some images of face mask policemen in Seattle and London. They're very common. There's also big arguments about remedies, and there are remedies from oxo and Bovril through to manganese and potash and incandescent gas burners to purify the air in your home, through to all sorts of patent medicines that advertise as preventing or curing the flu with very few results.
I went to my auntie in Louisville, Leichhardt, it was there, and her children didn't seem to get it. They burnt sulfur in the room all the time. They used to put sulfur on a shuttle and have that burning and nearly suffocated you. Her husband used to light it in their bedroom before they went to bed to kill the germs and have the burning down in the kitchen and all like that. So that seemed to save her family. She had 9 children and they didn't get it.
Well, the difficulty back then, of course, was that they knew practically nothing about viruses. So people thought in terms of cleanups and personal hygiene. So city councils, civic cleanups, get rid of rubbish, because a lot of people then still thought in terms of the old miasmatic theory of infectious disease, that infections were caused by bad smells and rotting vegetation and things like that, and disinfecting or fumigating places. In New Zealand, the remedy was to go to an inhalation spraying chamber and suck in vaporized 2% zinc sulfate solution. This was just basically a crude mouthwash disinfectant, and a very crude one indeed. And from a social historian's point of view, what interested me most were the reports of nervous people queuing up outside, coughing and sneezing at each other. In other words, the thing probably had no effect at all on the virus, but hey, the people clustered around the entrance were giving the flu to each other and helping to spread it. Patent medicines had a wonderful day. Things like Baxter's Lung Preserver and all the usual cough remedies sold out, and warehouses were emptied of that sort of stuff. My wife and I did some work on the flu in Japan, because Japan had a very moderate death rate by Asian standards for the 1918 flu, very similar to New Zealand's actually. And the official advice there was, if you feel you've got a fever, go home and go to bed and stay there. Drink lots of green tea, which has lots of vitamin C anyway. So that was not a bad piece of advice. The other thing we discovered, and I was absolutely fascinated by, was that the way they distributed herbal medicines in those days was on a kind of door-to-door sales scheme. And every household would have its box full of remedies, including powdered roots for fevers. One, for example, is called Kakonto. And this is peony root, which we now know is bung full of ephedrine. So it may have had some effect in reducing the fever symptoms and just helping people to get through a pneumonia case. But it was mainly the control of the fever and replacement of fluids, because I think in New Zealand, a lot of victims died in isolation in family settings where nobody had the foggiest idea what to do with the pneumonia case. The one thing they didn't realize was that you have to replace fluids. That, I think, is where a lot of people got dehydrated and died from that cause, as well as the pneumonia.
For a long time, a figure of 20 million was used, and it was produced by an American epidemiologist. But when you consider work by people such as Ian Mills's work in India, he looked at what happened there. And this is British India, so it stretches from modern-day Myanmar, Burma, all the way through to back to the Bay of Bengal, much lighter into it than is now. And he's argued that there's a minimum of 16.5 million deaths there. We have really poor numbers out of places like China and Russia. Myself and a colleague published a paper in 2002 on this, and our revised estimates of mortality put a minimum figure of global mortality from 1918-1919 flu of 50 million people.
In effect, more people died from flu in 1918 and 1919 than died in the whole of the First World War.
Many, many times more. Mortality for First World War is estimated at something like 8.5 to 10 million. And flu mortality, as we discussed, is 50 million and up. I mean, in countries such as Australia and the UK, we talk about a lost generation from First World War. But in many countries, actually, a lost generation is claimed by flu, not by war.
So how quickly then did the influenza disappear? Because you said it arrived amazingly quickly. And did it disappear just as quickly?
Well, in New Zealand it did. The graph of deaths tails away down to almost nothing by the end of December. So it was all over by Christmas. It had sort of burned itself out. But that's the normal way influenza operates, because the more people it infects, if they survive, of course, they've then got immunity to that particular virus. And so it's blocked. Once it's gone through the majority of the population, it's got nowhere to go and the virus just fades out.
Since 1919, there have been 2 flu pandemics.
The Asian flu of 1957, which was a new virus, a new type, and then that was replaced in turn by the Hong Kong flu of 1968. And we are still living in the regime of the Hong Kong flu. That's the basis of your seasonal winter influenzas. Those are the major ones that were pandemics. The death tolls from 1957, 1968, of course, were much, much lower, I think largely because of modern medical science. Pneumonic complications could be treated promptly with antibiotics. We've had other viruses reappear. This H1N1 has reappeared twice in 1973. The Fort Dix outbreak in America caused a very big scare, and they prepared masses of vaccine, afraid of a repetition of 1918, but that one didn't spread. The prompt quarantining of early cases stopped it from spreading. H1N1 was also present. It was misnamed the Russian flu for a while in the 70s, but it failed to find a foothold, an ecological niche.
The World Health Organization has issued estimates on how many people could die from bird flu if the virus begins to spread between humans. It says a mutated bird flu could kill as many as 100 million people.
Robert Webster, the New Zealander who is head of the CDC in Atlanta, I heard him talking once about this, and he said that H5N1 flu was one of the nastiest viruses he'd ever seen at the end of his microscope, because it sort of had a necrotizing capacity as well. It could sort of rot your tissues inside. And the fear that if that jumped the species barrier and could be passed human to human would cause another pandemic on the scale of the severe wave of 1918, that was a realistic prospect. And that's why health authorities responded so quickly and destroyed all the poultry in Hong Kong. And that seems to have nipped it in the bud and stopped it from spreading.
Fear is mounting as a new strain of a killer swine flu spreads around the world.
This new flu strain is a mix of swine, bird and human viruses.
I don't think that anyone who understands influenza, when they heard the news on Friday, figured there's almost no way of stopping it. The only chance would be that the virus petered out by itself, and that was extraordinarily unlikely. I know when I heard the news Friday, I thought this was it. And although, as we're speaking, the World Health Organization has not gone the final step, I think at this point, I mean, their current position is pandemic is imminent. Well, yeah, it's going to happen. But we still don't know what the virus is going to be like. All four pandemics we know about, historically, in any detail, have had first waves. In all cases, they were either relatively mild. I think in 57 and 68, the first waves may have been about the same as the second wave, but in both cases, they were not. They were serious, don't get me wrong, but they were nothing at all like 1918. So I'm not sure how the first wave would behave, and we don't know where it's going to go after that. There is a difference, however, between 1918 and the other three pandemics, and this is one thing that I hope is going to come true here. I mean, we only have four samples, so it's hard to say scientifically, but the 1918 virus came through directly from birds to humans without an intermediary. So it was a very foreign virus with no element of it that the immune system had seen before. Whereas in 1889, 1957, 1968, and also this year, the virus was partly an animal virus and partly a human virus already. So the human immune systems have already seen the human part of this virus. And that may give us a significant edge up. And that may explain, although this is pure speculation, why 1889, 57, and 68 were much, much, much milder than 1918.
Thanks to today's guests, John Barry, Jeffrey Rice, and Niall Johnson. Also to our voices from the archives, Douglas Miller, Beryl Duthie, and Kathleen Woodgate. Today's sound engineer is Judy Rapley, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince. Thanks as always for your company.
On Into the Music, The Nerve, Part 1.
Insects have these little hairy things on their legs that can sense the movement of the air. And these developed into hearing for us. Hearing is essentially a very sophisticated and nuanced way of detecting changes in the air.
Sound, Music and Humanity in 6 big episodes, beginning with the very nature of sound and how we experience it. Robin Johnston here with The Nerve on Into the Music. You can stream this program from the Radio National website.